Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. This podcast is something rather special. In April 2026, Mary Lou Stevens launched her fourth novel, The Hobart Hotel. Through the miracle of technology, we cross live to Hobart's infinitely glamorous Rest Point Hotel and Casino and her lively conversation with author Karen Brooks.
Oh, look, thank you so much for giving up your evening to come here to help Mary Lou launch her magnificent latest novel, The Hobart Hotel. And I just want to say thank you to Mary Lou too for inviting me to launch it. I've actually launched all of Mary Lou's books, and it's been so exciting to see the growth and the success. I'm so proud of her. Even though she looks like a Who from Whoville. Yeah. So.
Oh, is this on? Hello. Oh, it's on. I wanted to keep this a secret, but I did send it to my niece in Melbourne. And that's what she said. She said, "You look like a creature from Whoville." And I said, "Well, that's not quite the look I was going for, but thank you. And now I can never unsee it."
Okay. So Stuart mentioned that Mary Lou and I go back away, and in fact we knew each other on the Sunshine Coast. I think it was nearly 30 years ago now.
Not that long.
I know, it's incredible.
No,
so
it can't be that long.
We've sort of followed in each other's footsteps in a way, and so it's lovely. So last year we were at the Henry Jones Art Hotel, mm-hmm. and today we're in the wonderful Rest Point Casino, which is actually quite a controversial building, I've learned, but I'll get onto that later. So I think it'd be really appropriate, since I have the marvellous creator here, to ask Mary Lou, first of all, for those of you who haven't had the privilege and pleasure of reading the book yet, tell us about the story in your own words. No spoilers.
Oh, goodness me. So many spoilers in this book. So I always thought that the opening of Australia's first legal casino would make a great novel. Turns out I was right. It was just so controversial. It was the first legal casino in Australia, and it was here in Hobart. And when I found out that in 1939, the original hotel on this site, which still stands, the beautiful Art Deco Riviera, was also the most talked about hotel in Australia when it opened, I went, oh gosh, here we go. So the 1939 story is about Sabine, who comes to Tasmania specifically for the opening of the Riviera. And she has thievery on her mind. She is a jewel thief. She's recently arrived from the continent. And she is waiting out the war, if you like. Things have got, you know, it's just been going for a few months by the time the Riviera opens. And things are a little bit heated. So she comes down here, a safe port in the storm. But things go horribly wrong. And she ends up in Uruguay, of all places. And we might find out more about that later. And with Jenny, who's the 1973 character, She's a receptionist at the TGIO. She's a typical Hobart girl. She hasn't seen much adventure back in 1973. Those of you who remember what Hobart was like, not much adventure going on. And she is thrown into the world of being a ladybird, one of the very first croupiers here at the casino, much against her mother's wishes. So it causes a rift within the family, which she has to deal with. But there's also the mystery of a couple of things that come via a mysterious way, and that she has to solve too. And hopefully it'll help her out of a pickle.
That was really well done, with no spoilers. So as you can see, there's two timelines. One starts in the 1930s and the other is the 1970s. And I have to say, what I found, and you know, one features starts with the Rest Point Riviera Hotel, which I knew nothing about until I read the book, and of course the opening of Rest Point. What really shocked me, stunned me, was I just couldn't believe that something in Hobart, in Tasmania, would divide the community. I mean, I can't... That really shocked me. But no, seriously, the positives and negatives were fascinating, and you explore them beautifully through Jenny Davies and her mother particularly, but also through other social people in the community and things like that. But then I learned that your family had ties to the casino, the opening of the casino, and was also sort of divided and factionalised. Can you tell us a little bit about your family's personal relationship to the casino?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting one. So my dad was a Crown solicitor, so he was working for the Tasmanian government. And as you can imagine, there were a lot of legalities, a lot of to-ing and fro-ing that had to be done to get this casino up and running within the letter of the law. So he was actually involved in all of that to help the casino, you know, tick all the boxes. So while he was doing that, our mum, who was a staunch Christian, was absolutely against it. And not as staunchly as Jenny's mum in this book, but... and then my sister, my elder sister... She wasn't one of the original ladybirds, but she trained in 1973 and she became a ladybird. I was 12 when the casino opened, but I remember my sister practicing with her chips, with the chipping and with dealing cards. She was a blackjack dealer on the dining room table, and my mum just going, doing a slow burn, yeah.
And you worked in one of the restaurants here, is that correct?
I was 19. I worked in the grill room for a hot second, wearing one of those hideous green uniforms. I don't know if anyone remembers
the green. You don't like green?
When I said she gets in a bit of a pickle, I thought, I look like a pickle. No, this is beautiful. The uniform was hideous. Oh.
That headpiece and this, and there's more out the back, are actually from the Showgirls that used to perform here. And my girlfriend Lucy, who's in the audience, she brought a 1980s program, and I was so shocked to see there were topless Showgirls performing here. I know. Goodness, I'm from Australia and we don't have things like that there, no.
But the headdress is made up for the topless bit. You know.
Yeah.
All their clothes were on their head.
Now, I loved all the name dropping in the book because Mary Lou, of course, does fabulous research, and so she's drawn on the real histories. And, you know, there's the names like Lawrence Olivier and Vivian Lee who stayed here. There's, Noel Coward, and I love his part in it. And a lot of, I won't spoil it, but he's not just an entertainer. It's fabulous. But then Tiny Tim came here. Do you remember him, Tiny Tim? Yeah, yeah. And Paul Hogan, he didn't throw another shrimp on the barbie, but he did something.
Yeah.
But do you think that bringing those, well, because what's evident, or what I think the book was leading towards and we know now, is that the casino really did make Tasmania a destination.
Mm.
And did those celebrities help, like, and with the Rest Point Riviera Hotel, do you think that they, do you know, did that really help sort of elevate Tasmania in the mainland's eyes?
As far as the Riviera goes and my part of the history of the Riviera is 1939 to 1940. So there was a war going on. So that did restrict a lot of things. I mean, Arthur Drysdale had such a vision for the Riviera. He was an amazing man. So people probably know Drysdale House, the hospitality college, but he was the man with the vision behind the Riviera Hotel. It was a spectacularly bad time to open an incredibly glamorous hotel, but he still made it work. But the people came here, the famous people, for specific reasons, like Noel Coward. So there's a whole chapter with Noel Coward and why he was here and what he was doing. But also, you know, the opening of this casino in 73, and there's Jerry Lewis doing the opening stuff with the showgirls. And the cabaret room just had an amazing lineup of artists from all over the world. It really was... It did put Hobart on the map in so many different ways, and the level of entertainment was one of those too.
Did that change attitudes in the community when they saw, I guess, the kudos and the admiration and the fact it brought money in and tourists? Did attitudes change pretty swiftly or not?
I think the fact that it did bring in so much money, and there are probably people here who would know this better than me, but it actually did what it said it was going to do. I know so much of the money that went through the gambling tables went straight to the government. Also, at that point, as Tasmania often is, we were in a recession, you know. There were no jobs. It's 1973. The apple industry has just collapsed. That's the year it collapsed. And things are going downwards fast. And then you have the opening of this casino and people are flying in their droves, coming in cruise ships to come here to this place. And that was all the arguments for it, is that it would bring outside money to Tasmania, because a lot of the people who are against it were saying, you know, you're going to take money away from people. But it's okay if it comes from the mainland. So... people would fly here especially and just pump money through the tables, and a percentage of that would go to the government to provide infrastructure and all the things that governments are supposed to provide. And so there was, I think, a very positive influence, and Tasmania was seen as a place to go instead of, you know, this daggy backwater that was 50 years behind everyone else.
Those arguments are sounding so familiar, aren't they? Too soon? Sorry. I was absolutely fascinated by the descriptions of all the training that the croupiers and the chippies, I know, and we actually have two. The Ladybirds was the name given to the women who used to take charge of the tables and deal and count the chips. And we actually have two of the original Ladybirds with us tonight. Or three.
Yeah.
Well, I won't say. I knew two names because Honey Bacon and Ellie Bolt, is it? Yes. Are mentioned in the book.
And I met Mignon today, this evening as well. Yeah.
Sorry, can you... Oh, hello. Hello, it's so nice to... So lovely to see you here. But I learned all this new terminology, and I was just... And the math that was involved. I mean, I failed math in my high school certificate. I know, it's terrible. But how did you go about researching all that? I know that you spoke to the lovely ladies and drawn it there, and your sister, of course, but it's really interesting. And I also didn't know what the sort of expectations and the instructions about the way the girls had to appear, their hair, their makeup, their nails. It was really, really strict. And their uniforms, they had to have cleavage and all sorts of things. Can you talk a bit about your research for that and how you managed it?
Well, quite honestly, these two, Ellie Bolt and Honey Bacon, that's why the book is dedicated to them. And this novel would not exist without their help. So I emailed them. Yeah, thank you. I am just going to take a quick break and take this off because it's getting very hot and heavy. Oh, that's better. Goodness me. It looks like shrubbery.
No, I was going to say, we'll pat it. Yeah, it is like shrubbery.
I don't know how they wore those and danced and did everything they did. Anyway, yes, so... Ellie and Honey, I just asked them 1,000 questions and then 1,000 more. And their memories are fabulous. I asked my sister and she went, oh, Mary Lou, that was so long ago, I can't remember a thing. But it was exciting and glamorous. And just so you know, if you're basing a character on me, just say I loved it and it was very glamorous. So I went, okay, all right. Okay. But Ellie and Honey just were incredibly generous, talked about their memories, talked about every single thing, gave me fine details on all those mathematical stuff. Picture bets, I'd never heard of picture bets. Oh, it's a secret. We're not supposed to talk about picture bets.
It's in the book. Not much of a secret
oh,
now.
Oh, that's right. Yes, okay, not a secret anymore. And I think it was about the third draft of the 1973 story. I sent them a copy. So I was still quite early on and just said, you know, what mistakes have I made? And they said, oh, this and this and this and this. And yeah, just so incredibly, incredibly helpful. Because, you know, there is some written stuff about the details of this kind of stuff. I read Casino Royale by Ian Fleming. Oh, my goodness me. The descriptions of gambling just go on and on and on, and there was nothing useful at all. And I would watch videos. There are so many videos of how to play all these different games, but some of the rules are different to the way things were played here. So it really was Honey and Ellie who were the backbone of all our research.
Can you still do counting multiples of 17?
Yeah.
Holy hell. Oh, God, I have trouble remembering my times table. Wow. So are you lucky? Do you gamble at all?
No.
Interesting.
No, I don't. I was just thinking, I'm a bit like Jenny, you know, maybe a sweep in the Melbourne Cup, but not even that anymore. No.
Okay. No, not tempted to after doing the book?
No.
Okay.
No, isn't that interesting? I never thought about it, but no.
Yeah, I felt like it after reading it. Yeah. So. Okay, I'm going to move now to the 1930s and Sabine Winter's story, okay, which start at the start of World War II, as Mary Lou said. And can I just say how much I absolutely loved Sabine's sass? She is one sassy lady, let me tell you. And the repartee between her and the mysterious Mr. Grey, yeah. It's just wonderful. And she's a very different character to Jenny, who's a very wholesome, good-hearted, loyal Hobart girl, whereas Sabine is world-weary, well-travelled, multilingual, sophisticated and incredibly courageous, and let's say a rule-breaker. So who inspired her?
Look, mention is made of how she looks, and she does look a lot like Greta Garbo. And there's mentions of Mata Hari, Greta Garbo and Mata Hari. So there's a bit of the Mata Hari story. But Greta Garbo was incredibly independent in a lot of ways, and when she went, I've had enough, that was it. You know, she was gone. She did have a mind of her own. She did what she wanted. I mean, there's some movies she made where she's kind of silly and frivolous and wearing frills. And I watched one of those and I went, oh, it's really not what I was thinking. But most of the time, she's Greta Garbo. Yeah. You know? She was amazing, the way she looked, the way she acted, and her personal life. And so I think that she was a very strong influence.
Yeah, and I think that she really brings the glamour, you know, at a high level to the book. It's really different in a way to Mary Lou's other books, which were very food-focused, but they're about iconic Tasmanian foods. And this is, you know, the iconic building. I love that you've sort of got that sort of running through your books. And also in the book, there's Easter eggs for those who've read your other books. there's those of you who've read Mary Lou's backlist, you'll just go, oh, there it is. So whilst there's some commonalities, there's an overlap, and I won't spoil, between Sabine and Jenny's stories, there's a great point of difference I noticed. And I wonder if you'd talk about this, because I noticed that Jenny virtually finds her people when she comes to the casino. So she finds this real sense of community and togetherness, a real sisterhood, if you like, with the women here and with her old school friends too. Whereas that and you really explore the power of female friendship and support, which I love. Whereas Sabine, in contrast, was a complete loner. And she deploys her femininity and her feminine wiles as weapons, really, against the patriarchy. And her motives are both selfish, but they're also serving a greater good. So I just wondered, you know, was that deliberate that she chose not to sort of seek female friendship and keep herself apart because of, was that Sabine's character and her role? Like, was that deliberate to set them up in contrast like that?
Yes, very, very much. They both had to have incredibly different voices because of the roles they play and the lives they lead. And so I've written Sabine deliberately. Even her sentences are shorter, sharper, fragments, that kind of thing, because that's the way she thinks, that's her world. Whereas Jenny, as I said, is a girl from Hobart in the 1970s, and has a whole different outlook on life. And I love the thing about found family. And from talking with Honey and Ellie, it seems to me as though that really was the case here amongst the people who worked here, that it was found family. That because a lot of the people who came to work here came from the mainland. Yeah. They didn't have family here. But also working the hours and doing a job that nobody else in Australia did legally really drew people together. And also they were staying at the Riviera. Yes. So I kind of wanted to get a bit of that boarding school vibe. I actually have one of the characters saying, you know, it's like being at boarding school. But where people are close and people do stuff together and they go through their troubles together, and I love that. Whereas Sabine, through the way she lives and what she chooses to do with her life and how she was brought up, her upbringing out the back of New Norfolk, incredibly different to anything you could possibly imagine. So that's a very strong theme. Just how her father brought her up is a very strong, to be independent, to not be weak, to really not trust anyone, to always be strong. And that's how she's decided to live her life. And the choices that she makes are very much governed by those, driven by those.
Yeah, I really loved both characters, and I loved that they were so different. You did it really, really well. It was fabulous. Okay, so I'm going to now shift to Uruguay.
Uruguay.
Uruguay. So the majority of Sabine's story occurs in Uruguay. I knew nothing about Uruguay until I read your book. And then, of course, you go Googling. I think it's always a sign of a really good historical fiction when you start Googling or looking in books and other references to just chase up what's fact and fiction. So it was really significant country to both the Allied and the Axis forces. Mm. I did not know that the first naval battle of World War II was fought in the harbour there or outside the harbour, nor that it was considered the gateway to South America. So it was a great goal for either side to want to attain. And it's just so fascinating, that part of the book too, what goes on in that regard. So you spent 5 months living there. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
We originally were going to go to Argentina, but Milei, the Trump wannabe, had just got in, and it was a massive change for Argentina, and we weren't quite sure how the country was going to respond. So I said to my husband, why don't we just sit across the River Plate in Uruguay, and watch from a distance and see what happens in Argentina. So let's just do that for a while. And we liked it so much, we stayed. We got a visa extension for an extra couple of months. We made lots of friends there. And I got the idea for this book. So I was on tour for the chocolate maker and the chocolate factory. I always get those mixed up. The chocolate factory.
That's my book.
Yeah. It is. It's a good book too. The jam maker had just been accepted, and HQ said, what have you got for us next? And I just need to have such a strong driver to write a book. And I have to be really, really passionate about it because it takes 2 years of your life, as you would know, or more. And I knew I wanted to write a book about the casino, but I wasn't sure. I just didn't have enough. So we're sitting in Uruguay, and that's where I found out that the first naval battle of World War II happened off the coast where we were staying at Punta del Este. And I went, what? I didn't know that. How and why? You know, and I had to find out. And I found out because I was researching Rest Point, so I had found out about the Riviera by this point. And I found out that the naval battle happened in the very same week as the Riviera opened. And I went, I got a story now. I have something now. I can do something with this.
That's very Twilight Zone, isn't it?
This is going to be interesting. And in the early days, I'd say to people, well, I'm writing a book about the casino, but it's half set in Uruguay. And they'd go, what? I said, it'll all make sense. And it does. But Uruguay is an interesting country. It's really small. So it's got Brazil, which is massive with a big population to the north. It has Argentina, which is massive and a big population to the south. Buenos Aires, Argentina doesn't have a deep port. Montevideo does, which was why through the centuries everyone wanted it. And the Portuguese and the Spanish, you know, so Brazil and Argentina would fight over it all the time. They have these incredible old forts along the borderlines, you know, from centuries and centuries and centuries ago that were either built by the Spanish or the Portuguese, depending who was doing what at the time. But because of its position, Germany really wanted to get in there. And because of its position, Franklin D. Roosevelt really wanted to get in there. So there was a battle for Uruguay going on at the time.
And I also learned that they're great beef producers and, in fact, provided the bully beef for the Allied forces during the war. That was fascinating.
That's one of the reasons the Germans won it as well. Fray Bentos, there was a massive beef canning factory there. And so it was all exported. And, yeah, an army marches on its stomach, but it was marching on the bully beef from Uruguay. It's, I think, even now there's only 3 million people and like 12 million cows.
Oh, God. Is bully beef spam?
No, it's different.
Okay.
Yeah, it's... Okay. it's
it sounds ghastly.
It's kind of like, you know, it's a similar concept, but no.
Now, I said before, one of the joys of reading good historical fiction, and my God, yours is good, is, you know, learning stuff and finding stuff. But it's also, I was reading a few things that made me scoff, not at what you'd written, but at humans. And I just thought it was really pertinent to read just this little quote on page 105. There's a character that says to another, the port, talking about Montevideo, yep, is of strategic importance. In contrast to Buenos Aires, the harbour here can accommodate large ocean-going vessels. It was the reason Britain was so keen to get her hands on it. Now listen to this bit. They tried a couple of times through warfare, but it was diplomacy that secured them a place in Uruguay. There's a lesson there if we could only learn from the past. Yeah. And there's even another part where they're talking about oil in the Middle East and the prices going up. Seriously, and this wasn't happening when Mary Lou wrote this. So my question to you is, and I already know the answer, do we learn from the past, Mary Lou?
This is the fascinating thing about writing historical fiction, and the answer is no. But it just always amazes me when I'm researching and I'm finding out things that were happening back then. I mean, people say to me, you know, the world is so bad now and this is happening and this is happening. And I said, well, if you look at history, really bad things happen over and over again through the centuries, through the millennia. So it's, you know, there are some different things now, but a lot of it is very, very similar. And we don't learn. I mean, even when I was editing The Last of the Apple Blossom, which features the 1967 bushfires, most of Australia was on fire. And it's like there's nothing you can do about a fire front when it's coming through. Even 50 years later, there's nothing. And the thing about the oil, so in 1973 there was a massive oil crisis. I think it was Egypt and Syria decided to get back the land that Israel had taken from them in 1967, and everything, you know, the oil supply shut down, and yeah, the prices went up, and you know, here we are again. It just keeps happening. So I think, and you'll probably find this too, writing historical fiction gives you a really interesting perspective on how things work or don't work through the years. And there are some things that changed, and there have been a lot of improvements, but there are certain things you just go, wow, we're still doing that.
Yeah, I get quite despondent sometimes when I'm
Can I just
researching.
Say something funny?
Yes,
and I'm
please.
Sorry
go,
about this.
Go.
And this isn't in the book, but I find it amusing. So the diplomat who actually got Britain into Uruguay, and Britain used to supply like the train, the water, the gas, the electricity, the phones, he was sent to Uruguay. I think it was, so this is the 1800s, I think it was King George IV. Because Lord Ponsonby was very good looking. He was a handsome man. And King George IV didn't like the way that his mistress looked at Lord Ponsonby. So King George IV, I think it was the fourth, sent him to Uruguay.
As you do. Yeah. Wow. I love it. So you wrote The Jam Maker, from memory, in six different countries. Mm. How many countries did you write this book across? Because you would have heard that Mary Lou and Ken, her husband, slow travel. She's great to follow on social media. You see all these wonderful things. Can you remember how many countries you wrote this one across?
Oh, I think I actually write it in the book, in the acknowledgements. That's probably about the same, but I really wanted to write all of Sabine's story while we were in Uruguay. I really wanted to go to all the places that she went, the Hotel Argentino, which is just amazing, Piriapolis, Montevideo we stayed. We actually got to stay in the Palazzo Salvo, which is a phenomenal building, iconic. And we were staying in Punta del Este, where she spends a lot of time too. So I really did want to just knuckle down and get her story written. So I wrote all of Sabine's story while we were in Uruguay so I could get the geography, the architecture, everything right. And I had a fabulous time doing it because the architecture in Montevideo especially and the Hotel Argentina is it's just superb, really, really good. And we came back to Australia for a while. Yeah, I think it's probably about the same. I think it's about
six
countries.
Yeah. Right. Do you find that being away from Tasmania, is it easy to relocate yourself mentally, you know, through memories and emotions, relocate yourself here when you're writing the parts here?
Oh, when I'm writing the parts here. Yeah, that's a great question. I think for the 1973 parts, I mean, I knew what Hobart looked like. You know, I grew up just up the road from the casino. Bend One, Mount Nelson. and I have a really good physical sense of the town and what it was like because I was 12, so I remember what it was like. And because Ellie and Honey have such fabulous memories, so sharp, they were able to fill in other things for me about what it was like personally to be a ladybird back then and the attitudes to people. And There are quite a few complaints about the lack of nightlife here in Hobart at the time, but how the staff here made their own fun, had their own parties, did all that kind of stuff. And I think because Tasmania is in my bones and in my heart and in my soul, I do. It's actually an absolute delight wherever I am to write the passages set in Tasmania. Mm.
It comes through. It does come through. And I love reading it. I mean, it's my beloved home now too. And I really enjoy those passages. Okay, I've got some really quick questions for you. Okay. How do you come up with characters' names?
That also is a research thing. It's like, okay, Sabine is 29, 30 here. What was a popular name, you know, 30 years earlier? Mm. a lot of that happens. And with the 1973 story, it was like, what were the names of the girls I went to school with?
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah,
there was a Mandy, there was a Debbie, you know, there was a Lisa.
That's cool. That's good. That's
quite
a great
quite a few Jennies, lots of Andrews. Gosh, one year at school there were five Andrews in my class. Yeah. So, but for the other historicals, it really is. Say with Harriet and Ruth in the Jammaker, it's like, well, what was a popular name in the year they were born?
Yeah.
And the internet is a wonderful thing.
All right. What's your go-to comfort food when you're writing?
Well, it would have been chocolate, and for a long time it was. Look, I absolutely love a brewed chai, and I have to say, for a little while, Ken and I actually travelled with our favourite brand of chai, but it's so hard to get in other places. But just a nice cup of tea.
But that's a drink. What food?
Oh, food.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, because the food is so different everywhere we go. What's that? Can't get Cadbury's everywhere. Certainly can't get it in Morocco. Yeah, so, and honestly, I ate so much chocolate for so long, just between you and me.
Yeah, you post beautiful photos of cakes. Does that help?
Oh, well, in Uruguay, I did eat alfajores and all kinds of delicious things.
Is that where they have dolce? I can never say it. Dolce leche? Is that how you say it?
Dulce de leche.
Dulce de leche.
Yeah. Aisles of dulce de leche everywhere you go in South America.
So sweet.
And aisles of alfajores as well, which are the lovely little shortbread biscuits with dulce de leche in the middle, and they cover them with chocolate. They're just amazing. Yeah.
She's answered her comfort food. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what's your favourite genre to read?
Oh, goodness me, I read everything. Because there are so many great books out this month. I've actually bought 4 novels since I've been here.
Sorry? I said, is that all?
Is that all? Yeah, that's all. And they're all different genres.
Well, what are you reading now?
I went to Anna Maynard's launch because I'm starved of literary events when I'm on the road. I really miss it. I love going to author events. I'm so glad that Catherine Scholes' book is coming out next week and I can go to it. And I was looking through the Fuller's, you know, events, and I went, oh, and I can go to that one too. And Meg Bignall was interviewing Anna, and I went, I'm definitely going because I want to catch up with Meg, and there were, you know, other author friends there, and it was just fantastic because I miss that. I miss the writing community. I really miss author events. So I'm actually reading Anna Maynard's latest rom-com.
Ah, a rom-com. What's the title? Give us the title.
Flowers in July.
Great title.
Yeah.
Okay, what was the first book you read that made you cry?
Oh, my Lord. I have just gone to Henderson, The Rain King, which we studied. Ian's here. We studied with Gack. That was his nickname, in English literature when I was in matric.
Sorry, what was the title?
Henderson, The Rain King by Saul Bellow.
I don't know that.
It's an extraordinary book. It's literary fiction. It's a man whose life is in tatters, and he goes to Africa. And it's just the writing and the transformation that he goes through. But it might have made me cry because I had to write essays about it.
So do you read reviews of your books? Honestly.
Okay, this is honestly. When I was first published, absolutely, I wanted to read all the reviews. I wanted to find out what people thought, probably for the second one as well. For the Jammaker, because it was different to the other two books, and I wanted to find out what people thought. And for this one, because the Jammaker, and bless you all, did so well, I was actually really worried about how the Hobart Hotel would be received, because it's a very different book. It's a fabulous book. It's a cracker of a story. But I was concerned because people just loved the Jam Maker. They loved that story so much. And I thought, how are they going to respond to the Hobart Hotel? Because it is very different. So I did read the early reviews and goodness me, it was a relief.
Yes, they're going to love this one too, darling. It's going to be a huge hit. It's fantastic.
But there does come a time where I just stop because it's like, okay. And it's time to write the next one, as you would know.
Last of the quick questions. Do you ever Google yourself?
I do. I absolutely do. Yeah.
Why? I'm just curious. I'm really curious. Why?
When a new book comes out, I want to see what's being written about the book. So I guess I'm Googling the book more than I'm Googling myself. Yeah. And that's the only time I do it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I just want to see, you know, where it is and who's writing what about it. Yeah, so it's more about Googling the book.
Okay, I do have one more question. Have you ever gone into a bookshop and brought your book to the front of the thing and been caught asking for a friend?
And been caught? I must be sneakier than your friend.
Have you done it though?
I think I must have. I think because if the spine is facing out and it's like the covers are so gorgeous. Isn't the cover for this book just insanely good? That's Deborah Bilson. She did The Chocolate Maker as well. Love, love, love her work. And so I think it deserves to be seen. So
I do
it
too.
Needs
it's
to be
gorgeous.
Facing out.
Yep. Absolutely. All right. This is my last question before I throw out to a Q&A. What's Mary Lou working on next?
I'll tell you a funny story. So we had a meeting with Fuller's, Stuart, and the team from Fuller's this morning, and And the question was asked about, you know, we're doing this fabulous event and it's glamorous and it's the casino. You know, where are we going to go for your next one? And I said, the West Coast. We'll wear gumboots. It'll be raining. We'll be in the rainforest. There will probably be leeches. So I want to write about Leatherwood honey. It's the honey that so many of us grew up on, and I absolutely love it. And Tasmania is the only place in the world that produces Leatherwood honey. And so I was looking at the West Coast, where it all comes from, most of it, Northwest Coast, West Coast, most of it comes from around there. And I started researching a book 5 years ago about the Franklin blockade. And 5 years ago, I thought, I'm not ready to write this book. I mean, talk about contentious issues. And when I was looking at all the honey and interviewing all the honey producers and having a look at where their hives were and all that kind of stuff, I went, I can actually put these two things together and come up with something interesting. So that's what I've done. And hence the next launch, you're all invited to, you know.
Strawn.
I love Strawn.
I do too.
I've been there many times. I love it. No, we're talking about out in the rainforest with the leeches.
I can't wait to read it, Mary Lou. I can't. All right, now I'm just quickly going to say a thank you. I want to say thank you to the wonderful people from Fuller's, Tim and his team. They've just been amazing. They're always amazing. Also, to the staff and management of Rest Point, to so many of our author buddies that are here in this audience tonight. Honestly, the writing community in Tasmania is just so supportive. And not only that, there's reviewers here, some who have come from Australia just to be here tonight, looking at you two over there, and just appreciate it so much. Honestly, it's such a privilege to be part of this beautiful community. And you readers, you people who support us, just thank you, thank you, thank you. You make everything we do possible and worthwhile. We were able to do what we love. We write from our hearts using our own ideas and words.
Yeah.
Real. sorry. And also I want to say from myself, and Mary Lou too, but Mary Lou's going to do her own thank you. You don't need me to be your voice. To the lovely and hardworking Stuart, who with such grace and goodwill supports us and puts on these amazing events. Thank you. And again, thank you to each and every one of you who gave up your evening to be here tonight. It truly, truly means the world. Thank you. And finally, and most importantly, please join me in thanking our reason for being here tonight, Mary Lou.
Thank you, darling.
And of course, there are many books to sign and all her backlist, and she'll be out there signing. And don't forget, Mother's Day is coming up, and I can't think of a better gift than a signed book by Mary Lou. Thank you again, everyone. Over to you, Mary Lou. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen, for being such a wonderful in conversation host with me. And as Karen did say, she's done every single one of my launches for my novels. If I'd known you when my memoir came out, you would have done that one too. And it's been just a privilege to be Karen's friend for so long. And don't forget, Karen's books are for sale as well, and she's available to sign them. I do have a few thank yous, so think of these as the closing credits. Graham Tonks is here tonight. Where is Graham? He wrote the book... thank you. So Graham's over there. He wrote the book Rest Point... I'm going to get the rest of it wrong. But it is the definitive book on Rest Point, and it was... The Life of the Times and the People of Tasmania. There we go. It's in the author's note. The Life, the Times, and the People of Tasmania's Hotel. And it was just instrumental in me being able to get the history of everything right, the Riviera as well as the casino. And my fabulous sister-in-law, I've seen my brother, but is Lynn here? Where's Tobes? Oh, well, I'm not going to thank her if she couldn't come. Yeah, she's in the back of the book. If you want to find out what she did, it's in there. And I also want to thank Nadia Majuri, who's also a fabulous writer, and she's the one who went to the garage sale and bought so many of these fabulous costumes. Some of the headdresses are at the window at Fuller's that Adele put together. Thank you so much, Adele. And then my final thank you. I'm going to give him a standing ovation. My ladybirds, I call them my ladybirds. I have grown to love them dearly. So, Ellie and Honey, thank you from the bottom of my heart. I shall probably cry. You are an integral part of this book. Your lives and your knowledge and your love and your passion are woven through the words of Jenny in the Hobart Hotel. And honestly, I am forever grateful for your help and your enthusiasm and your love. And the dedication is for you, and I do say thanks for your memories.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company. Imagining the Past.